This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our show today, which is an interactive town hall about the COVID-19 pandemic. The same time we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. And after the show has been broadcast, you can find our program in an archive at that same web address. And today, we're looking at the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic on our agriculture economy and our rural communities. And with us to talk about these impacts, Doug Goring, North Dakota's Ag Commissioner. Thank you for joining us, Doug.
Hey, good afternoon, Doug.
Nice to share the name with you today. And Betty Brand is the USDA Rural Development Undersecretary, Deputy Undersecretary. She joins us as well. Betty, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And where are you as we speak? Are you working from home or are you downtown?
Well, USDA Rural Development is all going remote, has been remote for the last couple of weeks. So we all are in the interest of protecting our employees, protecting the customers and the community at large. We are working remotely, but operating fully, businesses continuing and communicating with our customers and stakeholders. And so I am not downtown, but I am fully functional, and so is my team.
All right. Doug, how about you? Are you at home? Are you hunkered down somewhere?
Well, this is business as usual around here. I'm in the office. I haven't missed a day in the office. I'm rotating staff in and out. I would say probably three-quarters of our staff is out, and they rotate back in. So much of what we do is regulatory in nature. It's hands-on. It's a lot of questions that have to be asked. We have over 100 different regulatory programs, so covering, you know, meat, milk, eggs, animal health, phytosanitary export certificates. We also have numerous inspectors that ensure that agribusiness is operating and operating in the manner they should, but also our ability to oversee the food and ag workforce side of it. So we're critical and essential to agriculture, just as agriculture is critical and essential to the public and to our nation. It's all about security, food security, and workforce security. So we're still working. We just have to rotate people in and out, and I have different support staff that comes and goes, but we're getting it done.
Well, the pandemic adds another layer of anxiety to this year's growing season. So, Doug, first of all, give us a snapshot of the most significant issues you're dealing with at this time.
Well, I'd probably start first with the H-2A work visas. That would be our immigrant workforce that comes in and works in sugar beet potato production, on our grain operations and our livestock operations. There has been multiple issues with countries shutting down and then also commercial air service not coming out of certain countries. Now working with the Department of Homeland Security, Department of Labor, and USDA, we've been able to expedite some visas and some interviews and make sure that they're front and center in those consulates and embassies. But if they're limiting the type of work they can do, that's been a bit challenging. We are going to have some real problems trying to get people in this year. The other thing has been wherever we can, we're trying to sort out what people are available to help on our farms and ranches. So we've been working with Job Service North Dakota, working with WSI, trying to find out if people receive some of their unemployment benefits for being laid off or furloughed, how much can they earn off from there to go out and help some of our farmers and ranchers. We've been able to determine that in probably most cases you could probably earn up to $370 a week helping with food and ag labor force and not hurt your benefits at all. The other has been CDL services. We've got about 312.
These are truck drivers?
These are truck drivers. We have about 312 people in the state of North Dakota that are waiting to be tested, exam, you know, with the written exam plus the driving exam, that part of it. Working with Bill Panos, the director of DOT, they are implementing some appointments and going to try and expedite this, streamline it, and have most of these people taken care of by the end of April. That's what they're looking at. Some of the other issues have been with our restricted use pesticide certifications. We had about 3,000 of them that were not able to or were supposed to be certified by April 1st. That became a problem. We worked with the governor. He did issue an executive order, bought us about 60 more days to try and work through that issue. Livestock licensing has been another issue for those livestock auction markets. Working on a lot of protocols for workers, returning people to the state. If you got, you know, food processing facilities, how are they handling that? Really trying to apply a lot of common sense and make sure that we're mitigating risk. Also, looking at essential services out there. I think a lot of people, there's questions about, well, what's essential, what's not. There's been some confusion over some of the small livestock animal sales that are generally for kids shows, youth shows. We've had to pretty much tell them they're not essential and they're not something that you can go forward with unless you can do it online or have some web-based way of having your little livestock sales. But for the larger livestock auction markets, that's very essential to our ability to have food produced, moved, marketed through the right channels, and working with those livestock auction markets to make sure they have protocols in place and guidance to respect social distancing.
I'm going to cut in here, Doug, and just to give Betty a chance to respond to a similar question here. Betty, USDA Rural Development, what is your principal focus today? What are the big issues? I know that you deal with single-family housing and business and industry loans and direct loans and grant programs in the state. Give us a snapshot of what your priorities are.
Yes, well, thank you so much, because you did give the good highlight of what our programs are. Basically, our mission is to help improve the economy and the quality of life in rural America. So you're exactly right. The business and economic development, what we work on, community facilities, housing, and then the infrastructure as well. That includes water, electricity, and broadband. So we are predominantly focusing on our existing customers and making sure that we have provided any type of forbearance that is allowable and communicating with them the options. We really encourage people to reach out to their state office. And just to let you know, anyone in North Dakota can contact the state director, Claire Carlson. He's in Bismarck. And the website is www.rd.usda.gov/nd, and find out more information about the various opportunities that there are for immediate relief. Likewise, we do have some of our programs that receive funding from the recent CARES Act, which includes money for our Reconnect program, which is our broadband high-speed internet program, and we'll soon be deploying that money to continue the work done to provide high-speed internet, which is so important in rural communities. We also have some money that is available for a business and industry loan guarantee program. We have a notice that is getting ready to go out to the public. It's going through clearance now that will describe that program and help help those rural communities with some additional money that would be immediately available. And then we also receive about $25 million for our distance learning program, or DLT, and that is a great program where we have the new window open up for applications on April 14th that will close all the way, will go, be open until July 13th, and that is available for entities that are state and local governments, federally recognized tribes, nonprofits, and for-profit businesses to help them with anything they might need to help provide distance learning, either telemedicine or for educational purposes, anywhere from broadband transmission facilities, audio, video, interactive equipment, and those sort of things. So we're really focusing on helping businesses and communities immediately with the framework that we have available and the money that Congress has provided. Our goal is to immediately respond to customers, provide them new funding as we can, and make sure people understand the programs that we have that can help with the situation as communities are struggling and trying to learn how to operate differently than any of us have ever been exposed to.
Doug, Betty mentioned the $2 trillion CARES Act. Several bills were passed by Congress as the pandemic emergency was developing, and some of them offered some specific support for farmers and ranchers. What do you think is the most important aspect of that support?
Well, for our livestock producers, it's going to be the MFP program that's being worked on right now. In fact, we're working on some of that. I've worked with some of my colleagues and are meeting with some from organizations here in North Dakota. That's going to be critical to get some money directly into livestock producers' hands after the market's just imploded. A couple other areas have been along the lines with the SBA or Small Business Administration, working with some farmers to identify the Paycheck Protection Program or the Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program, and helping farmers understand how they need to navigate through that, what's applicable to them. The other thing that's coming up this Wednesday, we believe there's going to be some new guidance from SBA for the self-employed / farmer ranchers so that they may be also eligible for some of those emergency loans that have a grant aspect to them where there'd be some debt forgiveness if they meet certain criteria going forward.
We have a voicemail from Karen Ahrens, and we want to share that question that she has to pose for you. We also want to remind our listeners that they can give us a call toll-free, 888-755-6377. Of course, this is for our live broadcast at 3 p.m., our replay at 7 p.m. We won't be taking any calls. But first of all, let's listen to Karen.
Hello. This is Karen Ahrens, board member of the North Dakota Local Food Development Alliance. In addition to the programs that may be available for large farms and large farmers, we'd love for you to share a little bit more about the assistance that is available for small farmers, farmers markets, direct sales producers, and CSAs. Thank you so much.
Doug, farmers markets and support for, you mentioned a bit about those people who are kind of contract workers of their own little business, if you will.
Yeah, that's the part we're sorting through and going to have to wait to get some information back from SBA. There's a lot to this stimulus package, this CARES Act, and we're trying to make sense out of it and see what's applicable for both the medium, large farms, and also our small farmers. We do have a growing movement of local produce and local marketing in the state, and these are some areas we're looking into. Certainly when we look at that self-employment aspect, we're hoping there's something that's eligible for them there too. The other thing that's being sorted out is in that $14.5 billion that was set aside for USDA to look at specialty crop and farmer market type of programs, along with the livestock MFP program. They haven't written the program yet, so we're trying to provide some sense of what the need is out here, and they're not quite there yet. I know they have people working on this, but they seem to be prioritizing according to what they feel is more of a need right now, and I know that the Congress has pushed hard on the livestock part of it, so that's when more of the emphasis has been.
Betty, food security, there are some food deserts out there. Grocery stores have closed in lots of rural areas around our state and the country at large. What does USDA Rural Development do to sort of help meet that need?
Well, certainly rural development is one of the many parts of USDA that is interested in food security. And so from a rural development perspective, first off, we have been working quite closely with SBA to make sure that they understand and are connected to our rural communities and understand the needs, which may be different than many of their urban, more urban counterparts that they, which is probably where a majority of their funding goes. We have, in fact, earlier today, USDA had a stakeholder call with many lenders that operate in the rural communities and trying to share questions and ideas and trying to consolidate many of the questions that the commissioner just recently mentioned so that we can work together to get those answers and to get those agriculture producers and rural businesses, allow them to have access to that funding that is available. In addition, we still have all of our programs still in their regular cycle. For example, the Business and Industry Guarantee Program, that is not available for agriculture producers, but any type of sector that is a part of that, say a food distribution center, any type of business that supports agricultural production would be eligible and would also be eligible to participate in the program that will be rolled out with the money that was received just recently in the CARES Act. That notice will go out again. It's going through clearance now, and hopefully will get out soon to the public, and people can apply for that as well. So we also have other programs that are more long term, maybe not immediate, but supporting the food sector, local farmers markets, those sort of things. Those programs are continuing to operate within their regular cycle.
Doug, you mentioned that Phase 3 COVID-19 legislation included some investigations of price fixing by meat packers and why live cattle prices are falling, box beef prices are climbing. We've got people running on supermarkets these days, and yet the same time this is happening, there's been a drop in prices for ag commodities that's on top of the trade war drops that we've had before and the oversupply issues. What's going on?
Well, that's a good question because we are wondering the same thing and have been pushing to see if there can be a deeper investigation and maybe even some recommendations when you look at how you change the mandatory price reporting, for example. A lot of my colleagues and myself don't believe that the law is being enforced that's in place. For example, there's a limitation on packer ownership of livestock. There's some evidence that would suggest that there are some packers that have owned livestock longer than what they should. I believe it's 7 or 10 days they're allowed. We're also looking at how mandatory price reporting has been manipulated in the way that they're doing business with the feedlots and the farmers and livestock operations out there. Those are things we put on the table. We'll continue to have questions. I can't tell you what the investigation is about, who's doing it, how they're doing it, but I know that we have a lot of questions and would like to see this move forward, get it straightened out, because it doesn't make any sense.
The toll-free number for our COVID-19 Main Street Interactive Town Hall with Doug Goring, North Dakota Ag Commissioner, and Betty Brand, USDA Rural Development Deputy Undersecretary, is 888-755-6377. That's 888-755-6377. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. Betty and Doug, for that matter, are there bills, you know, expenses that farmers and ranches and rural business owners can overlook for now? I mean, we've got renters and landlords sort of at odds with each other. Is this a matter of just everybody self-prioritizing their own circumstance?
With respect to agriculture, a few concerns we have is, first of all, we still have operators out there that have not received their operating loans for the year. And some of them are FSA borrowers. We don't want to see a disruption in how those loans are being serviced, how that paperwork's being done. We also know that in the private sector we have, with this disruption, things have been slowing down, and we have those producers that have not necessarily gotten their loan work done either. So that's one of the first things for most ag producers. Once you have your operating, you should be able to operate the way you need to. I don't see any opportunity to forego paying a bill. Most of our creditors are not going to like that. And it's a bit of a problem I know that they're dealing with in the public sector, but in agriculture it's really not an option.
Betty, you give loans. You give, you know, you arrange loans for people. Is there any forbearance at this point?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I concur with the commissioner that always you need to communicate when you're struggling, have a hardship or anything. It's always best to communicate as soon as you know there's an issue with your lender, with the state office, to let them know. Oftentimes, if you communicate soon, there are some options that you might be able to explore, but the longer you wait, the harder it is going to be to exercise those options. And but through multifamily housing, for example, borrowers can request forbearance if they're experiencing financial hardship due to the COVID-19. Likewise, in the single-family housing, the Business and Industry Loan Guarantee Program, all of those have different scenarios that they are allowing people to defer payments for some of them as long as 180 days. And the best place to find that information, the specifics on each program, is to go to the RD website. It's www.rd.usda.gov. And the very first thing you'll see on that homepage is COVID, a big window with COVID-19 on it. And you can just click on that, and you can find out all the forbearance information that is going on. We also have another notice that is going through the Federal Register, will be submitted tonight and will be published in a day or so, that gives additional guidance on our guaranteed loans in business and industry, our community facilities, our Rural Energy for America program, and the water and wastewater programs. That additional guidance will be submitted in the Federal Register and will be available. If you go to that website, www.rd.usda.gov, you can go to the bottom of the homepage and actually put in your email address, anybody can, and subscribe to those stakeholder notices. So as soon as it becomes public, a stakeholder notice is issued, and you will receive that information right in your inbox. So it's a good way to keep up with what's going on in the different programs and have it at your fingertips, so you'll know. We're working on things daily, trying to look for opportunities to continue to give people some relief from a very tragic situation.
That's Betty Brand, USDA Rural Development Deputy Undersecretary. We're talking with her and Doug Goring, North Dakota Ag Commissioner, in our COVID-19 Main Street Interactive Town Hall. We're thankful for the support for this interactive town hall series, provided by the Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Dakota Caring Foundation. And we'll have more of our discussion with Doug and Betty after the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Otter Tail Power Company has filed its generation resource recovery rate for its North Dakota customers. It's an annual filing with the North Dakota Public Service Commission. PSC Chairman Brian Crosius says for a homeowner using 1,000 kilowatt hours of electricity, the monthly bill would go up by $2.70. For commercial customers using 400 kilowatt hours per month, the bill would be $675 higher. Krasha says this filing includes the Astoria gas plant in South Dakota, which, paired with the Maricourt wind facility in North Dakota, will replace the old Hoot Lake coal plant in Fergus Falls, Minnesota.
The retirement for Hoot Lake is in 2021. I believe it is in May, approximately, is when they plan to retire that facility. It's a 1950s era coal-fired plant. The coal comes in from the Powder River Basin.
Krasha says Otter Tail wants to have this in place by July. The PSC suspended the rate to see if anyone wants a hearing on it. The executive director of the North Dakota Horse Racing Association says he's looking at televising the horse races from both Chippewa Downs in Belcourt and the North Dakota Horse Park in Fargo. Jack Schultz says he's talking to cable television operators about the idea. He says it would be a way to generate more interest in the live races. Schultz says a Nebraska track has started doing this.
And they have had what I would call real good success with viewership and online betting on the races.
The chairman of the commission, Dave Pepcorn of Fargo, likes the idea.
I think the whole having it on video is going to be a great thing. And I think we should maybe talk to different media companies to find out what that would cost. Because I think, especially if it's done well, that's going to be a great thing.
The commission told Schultz to continue working on the idea. And the Democratic nominee for governor, Dr. Shelley Lenz, has chosen a former state lawmaker from Sharon as her lieutenant governor running mate. Ben Vig served in the North Dakota House from 2007 until 2010.
I believe my experience in agriculture and energy will bring a full scope of understanding of the issues facing North Dakota. Together, we will work to transition to the future of North Dakota and how we move forward. I share Dr. Shelley's dedication to bread and butter issues, working from our children to young families to our senior citizens and everyone in between.
Vig won the support of the Democratic State Committee over the weekend and will be on the ballot after the paperwork is filed today. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. We're conducting our COVID-19 Main Street Interactive Town Hall. Today we're focusing on agriculture and rural development in our state. And Doug Goring, our North Dakota Ag Commissioner, is with us by phone. Betty Brand as well by phone. She is the USDA Rural Development Deputy Undersecretary. Doug, I think this may have been dealt with on your website, but I do think that there's some important guidance to be offered here. This email came in to us. We just held our annual meeting under the question of what do we do? Now we are faced with North Dakota tax equalization meetings. It goes on and then says, I have been in the cornfield. I have punched numbers for the farm bill. I have invested numerous hours in learning for our farm and still trying to get the deadlines met for tax assessments for the two townships that I cover. I have not been asked how we are doing our meetings, nor have I been contacted by the county to say this is what you could do. We are left to fend for ourselves. Is it true that a legal meeting of the state has to be held to the best of its ability, and even the governor cannot call it off? What's the circumstance with public meetings or important meetings like this?
Well, that's a great question. We've recently had an Industrial Commission meeting, which is the governor, the attorney general, and myself. And we practice social distancing. We found the biggest room in the Capitol and set up tables about 12 feet apart from each other and had a few staff in the room that recorded, took notes, gathered information, provided us with documents and materials. I'm not quite sure how, and although that's a ways out, we have the Central Assessments meeting that will take place in July, and then we have the August meeting with the State Board of Tax Equalization that will take place, and generally that is a very large room already with a lot of people in attendance. When we get to that point, I suspect we'll have to come up with something. I don't know if we rent the Civic Center and have everybody sit 6 feet apart and then try to make that work. I'm not even going to guess how we mitigate the risk there, but I really believe that county commissioners, township officers, everybody out there that's having to work through this issue, whatever they can do remotely, online, by Zoom, it's probably going to be the best way that they can function for now. We really anticipate probably when we get to May and June, we might have a whole different environment we're working with. That's where we're holding out hope, just working with reality and not getting caught up in the what-ifs.
The toll-free number to ask a question of our two people today is 888-755-6377. Again, you can email us, as somebody already has, at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. Betty, in the coming weeks and months, you're learning stuff day by day about how the response is playing out there and what the needs are that are popping up that might not have been foreseen. How might government policies be tweaked in your area to improve the economic circumstances, the return to normal, whatever that is, for rural towns?
Well, that's a very good question. There is no doubt that we are learning things even today that probably will be implemented in long term because they have proven to be more efficient and made us more available to our stakeholders and customers in these rural communities. I think going forward, public policy is going to now be considering the aspects of what if, how can we become more available should we have to deal with this in some form or fashion in the future, and the ability certainly of high-speed internet to our rural communities is just so crucial so that they have the access that other communities have, and I think that will still continue to be a priority. We've had some really great stories of communities that have really, and people in rural America are so, I would say, have the most ingenuity and creativity when it comes to fixing things and trying to sort through problems with the help of each other, working together. And we've had a company, for example, in Oklahoma that received some support from our Reconnect, the rural broadband program, and they are stepping up and making sure that all their students in their service area have high-speed internet so that they can receive that distance learning that is crucial. The school's ability for a child to continue learning in this process is so very important. So as we continue to look forward in the short term, our goal is to make sure that the immediate needs are met. And then very soon after that, looking towards responding to inquiries from Congress about what we see and what we've heard about the needs of our communities. That's why it's important to participate in calls like this today so that we can hear from the community and share that from our perspective and how our programs may be able to serve those communities better and those individuals. And then finally, in the long term, I think that our policies will always factor in that ability to make sure that our programs and those of Small Business Administration and other federal partners that we have, that truly they consider and factor in what the rural communities need as well as the urban, so that it's a broader and more available to everyone.
Well, Betty, you mentioned the need for broadband internet and the importance it has, especially now as kids are at home learning online, and they are severely disadvantaged if they don't have the laptop or the broadband signal. Distance learning is now the way it's being done. Doug, let's talk about something that you brought up early that is probably going to be extremely important in the coming months, and that is these foreign workers, the people, immigrants typically from south of the border, or not immigrants but foreign workers, if you will, who come into this country and into our state and do the absolute critical farm work that no one else is doing.
Yeah. Well, and it's one of the reasons for the last decade my colleagues and I at the national level have worked together to really push the issue and try to separate out immigration from farm labor. We've always gotten caught in the crosshairs, and that's a problem. We need a workforce that is willing to do the work, whether it's in animal agriculture, whether it's in the field. And it's probably why, if you look, there's two different areas where we generally get our workers from: Central America and then from South Africa. And the ones that come from South Africa are generally highly educated, highly skilled. They can run a lot of the computerized equipment and databases. When you think about the type of equipment that's being used on the farm now with the combines, the planting equipment, the tractors and seeders. And when you get to the other jobs where you're looking at animal agriculture and some of the other, I don't know if I'd call it backbreaking labor, but certainly where it's a hands-on, very interactive, it's where we need a lot of those workers that want to do and are looking forward to doing those jobs. Those are jobs that people we just can't even get from our neighborhoods anymore, let alone getting your nephew or a few from town that would come out and work on the farm during the summer or the spring. So it's critical that we have that workforce, or food and agriculture will shut down and it will become more costly. And as resilient as agriculture is, they continue to be very innovative, as Betty has said. They have limitations. There are certain jobs that you have to have that human component there.
If you have a question for our experts, Doug Goring and Betty Brand, the number is 888-755-6377, or you can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. Betty, many of us are concerned about the overall condition of our nation's economy. Now, we're not asking for a decision between, you know, do I decide between the health of the nation or its economic health? The pandemic, though, has heightened concern about deficits and debt. We did have a $2 trillion bill that came out that might be the forerunner of other trillion-plus dollar bailouts or necessary investments, if you will, in our future. How would you describe the concern about deficits and debts among policymakers and the people you serve?
Well, so that's a very good question. I know we are in unprecedented times, and the actions taken by Congress to try to address these issues and to address the health and safety of both our population and our economy, they are struggling and working through that even as we speak, and continuing to work through that. As far as personally, we in rural development, our mission is to deliver the programs with the funding that Congress provides to us. And we work very hard to make sure that even if we're not in our offices, but we're operating remotely, however, that we continue to provide that service to our customers and make that money available as quickly and as efficiently as possible. So with regard to the national debt, I am sure that everyone has an opinion on that, but I will say that it's just unprecedented times right now, and I know as we work through that, there will be some hard decisions that Congress has to make, and I'm very thankful that they are working on that.
Doug, is there an assessment of the effects of the ongoing trade disputes and the amount of commodities in storage waiting for better prices? And then you've got the effects of a pandemic compounding this math problem. Is there any light at the end of this now several years long tunnel of weak prices?
Yeah. Actually, there's two parts of that that I'll answer. Things still continue to move forward with respect to some of the discussions that are happening with trade agreements. For example, they're still working through on the Phase 2 trade agreement with China. The other one that's new that maybe many people haven't heard about or even know about is the U.S.-Kenya free trade agreement. Some of our concerns are that there has been some groups like the National Governors Association that has asked for a pause to be put on, hit the pause button, on rulemaking and non-rulemaking notice procedures. This concerns us greatly because you have trade agreements that are in the works. You have trade agreements that are already out there. We're still waiting to get comments on USMCA. To finalize that, you can't just push pause. Even with the U.S.-China trade agreement, you can't hit pause on that. There are the NEPA issue on environmental assessments, taking us years to finally get a decent rule in place, and we have that, and if you push pause on that, it could take us 5 years. I mean, we've seen things when it's hit pause that it's 5 years, but years that it could slow down the process. So that concerns us greatly when I know it seems like the common sense thing to do, let's just slow down and stop for a minute, except in government. Once it's rolling, you have to follow through on it. These things have been put in place to create efficiencies, and it's doing exactly what we have always asked for. Let's streamline government. Let's create efficiencies and be responsive to the public. Now, on the other side of that equation, Since we're in the process of printing money faster than we can almost spend it, I say that tongue-in-cheek, we do see that we're probably going to deal with inflation in the future. We're more than likely going to see the value of the dollar decline. That's actually a bright side for mining, for agriculture, for timber, for manufacturing, because all of a sudden our products become affordable in the global market, and imports not so affordable. That's a good setup for agriculture. They've been waiting for a long time. 2012, when we had a reasonable dollar, we were almost on par with Canada. We didn't have trade issues. When you're the highest currency in the world, you can't hardly sell anything. So this could be a bright spot for us. The downfall is that we are probably more than likely going to see inflation, higher interest rates. It's going to hit a struggling economy, but the bright spot would be for agriculture down the road. We will probably see some adjustments to all these prices. It might be affordable, and it might make some of our other industries more viable to operate in this country.
Well, at the same time, there is, I think, consensus that at this point we're in a recession. The economic numbers seem to point to that. We've got unprecedented filing for unemployment, something like 10 million with more on the way. The markets have been severely hit. There's the threat, frankly, of a depression. And you have farmers who have been under stress, and you've got rural communities that have been losing population. So I'm going to ask both of you, if you were to look down the road a year or two, what do you think would be the impact on the number of farmers and, for that matter, the viability, the ability of rural towns to maintain the services they have? Doug, you first.
Yeah, great question. Maybe I'd back up and take the last 10 years with the 10-year census we just went through in agriculture. We saw farms go from 31,000 down to 26,000. Do I believe that's probably a trend that's going to continue? Yes. And it's probably something that's a little bit unavoidable. The reason that most farms and ranches, livestock operations get a little bigger every year is because you can only squeeze so much margin out of every acre or every animal unit. So it forces you with increasing cost of living to get a little bit bigger and to create more efficiencies. Services are going to be a big deal. Agriculture continues to, as they try to be more efficient, they also realize that they can't do everything. So then you start hiring more services. You start looking at more tech-driven types of products and services there, too. We see more consultants out there and about. I would suspect that if we can maintain status quo and not lose any more, otherwise our services and products are going to come further away, and that might mean a little bit more shrinking of our rural communities, those communities that house a lot of our little towns that provide processing and provide repairs, other services to agriculture. I hope not, but that's in part why we want to work to find ways to encourage and support them in servicing that community and servicing agriculture.
Betty, I want you to respond to this as well.
Yes, thank you so much. I think looking down the road, I hope there's going to be a greater sense of urgency to allow these communities to have opportunities to connect to high-speed internet, to give those opportunities for not just for learning the capabilities for students and also but for extending the medical treatment and ability for people to receive really top-class medical care through telemedicine. And I know that in our rural communities, hospitals are and medical centers are really struggling. And we know that things are going to, we're going to have to look at things differently, and yet we don't want our rural communities, the citizens, to have to drive an hour or more, especially for critical care. And so I think down the road, we're going to have to look at innovation and technology, not just for the ag sector and helping them become more efficient, but also to bring some of those just crucial services to people and communities. I think I have seen as my travels throughout the country how important manufacturing is into these rural communities, and the ability to have United States making things. And at some point in time, I think there will be a greater appreciation, not just for the fact of understanding finally maybe where our food comes from and how important farmers are for us to have that food security and a value of what they do in that industry, as well as other manufacturing or manufacturing industry as well, and the ability to produce things that are needed to rebuild our economy overall. And so I really do believe that fundamentally things are going to be different, but there's so many good things that we're doing now that will be implemented, and I think that will help us draw together and keep those things moving forward so that in the future we can implement those things and come out better on the other side.
Well, Betty, you just said something, working together. We've had this red state, blue state, this deep partisan division in this country now for quite a long time, and sometimes it takes a momentous event, and we may be in the midst of one right now, to bring us together. So we've got a couple of minutes left. Doug and Betty, and Doug, you first. Let's talk about how we can get through this together.
Well, I think that's wonderful when you do get a community and you do town hall meetings. And although we're a bit limited on our ability to be face-to-face, it's exactly the type of sentiment we need going forward. It's what we've done in the past. It doesn't matter what your philosophy is, your background. Being involved in the conversation and bring in that intimate knowledge that you have of your community, your industry, the services you need, and Betty's absolutely right. Quality of life is another aspect of all this that we need to continue to encourage and help people focus on so that we can get more younger people into those communities also. But it is about let's embrace each other, embrace what we have in common, and don't look at what divides us, what separates us. Look at what we have in common, not what we disagree about. And that's going to be a good place to start. I've said it several times that, together we make one great person. When I get a room full of people and we start trying to build a better mousetrap and build programs, we put a lot of things aside and we focus. And when we do that, you'll just see this element of brotherhood and sisterhood happen, and we start to recognize the value in each other and the value in the industry and the society that we serve.
Betty, I'm going to have to leave it there, but I think you set us up for this sort of kumbaya moment, the time that we can get together and solve a very serious problem by putting our heads together and making some kind of consensus out of this. I want to thank both of you for being with us today for our COVID-19 Main Street Interactive Town Hall. It's Betty Brand, USDA Rural Development Deputy Undersecretary. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Doug Gorin, North Dakota Ag Commissioner, thank you as well.
Thank you, Doug.
Wednesday on our show, we'll have a Main Street Interactive Town Hall to discuss the challenge of schooling during a pandemic as students across the state go online for learning. If you'd like to submit a voicemail question or comment for our participants that day, give us a call at 701-428-1686, 701-428-1686. Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public's COVID-19 Town Hall Series is provided by the Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Dakota Caring Foundation.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 6th. North Dakota's 1977 legislature is probably most notable for its evenly divided House of Representatives and a dispute over the lieutenant governor's veto power in the Senate, an issue that wasn't resolved until voters had their say a year later. It wasn't an easy legislative session. On this date, in 1977, the Senate met in the morning for end-of-session ceremonies eagerly watching for the House vote on a Republican proposal of a 70-cent per ton coal severance tax. The tax rate was a major fight between the two chambers, with the Senate a majority of Republicans and the House a 50-50 split between the two parties. Senate Republicans talked of a potential special session in June, or continuing the current session another 3 days if the House rejected the tax rate. Amid the coal tax deadlock were key votes on public television funding and school aid, plus an $18.5 million building bill. After lengthy discussion and compromises, the last day of the session adjourned around 7 a.m. on Friday, completing a 20-hour marathon. The lawmakers had crafted the state's first two-year budget of more than $1 billion and passed North Dakota's first charitable gaming law. North Dakota lawmakers have 80 days every 2 years to write new laws and budgets, and in 1977, the Senate used 67 days and the House 66. In 2013, they used them all. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
You can purchase a book of Dakota Datebooks at shopprairiepublic.org. Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them, in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
On a reservation in Wyoming, some Native American families are crowded into two-bedroom houses.
Me and my husband, we have 8 children.
Putting them at extra risk of spreading COVID-19.
If one individual tests positive for it, of course it's going to be hard to quarantine just that one child and us as parents.
The challenges of a pandemic when housing is in short supply. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, we'll talk with Mick Belts, the coordinator for medical ethics instruction for the University of North Dakota School of Medicine, about the many ethical dilemmas that can arise in a pandemic. And Dr. Michael Roseman is a clinical psychologist and behavioral health columnist for several publications. He'll talk about the mental stress challenges facing farmers. And we're always asking for voicemails for our next interactive town hall. And you can make those voicemail questions by giving us a call at 701-428-1686. That's 701-428-1686. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday and our next interactive town hall on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.